Senator Daley, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman, and good morning to everyone. Senate File 933 has had quite a journey, as Senator Nienau could attest. We started out in this room in State Gov, and we went to the Reform and Redesign Committee for three successive weeks. I think it was in February. It might have spilled over into March. And throughout those meetings and different efforts by many stakeholders, we were able to come up with a language which is quite a bit different than the original bill. Ultimately, it will achieve the same intent, I believe, over time. And we've got the buy-in from all stakeholders. So it is with that I bring the bill to you today. It originally started off as the Back Office Consolidation Act, and now it's essentially a benchmarking study, something that we discussed at the One Minnesota Conference in late January as we were kicking off this legislative session. Over time, once implemented, it will save the state millions of dollars. It will redesign how we're conducting our back office functions ultimately. And to get it kicked off, we do need this benchmarking study. We've allocated $450,000 for the study. We're hoping that it won't require quite that much money, but we do have that set aside for this effort. And I guess I want to thank you, Senator Roebling, as much as anyone here to facilitate this. I very much appreciate it. With that, there is an amendment that Senator Bonhoff would like to introduce. And I don't know if she's on the Finance Committee.
I am.
Oh, okay.
Senator Bonhoff.
Madam Chair, and before I do that, I just want to acknowledge Senator Daley and Senator Nienau, the work of that Reform Committee. I mean, for us to spend 3 weeks really on this bill shows what can happen if you have a bunch of policy wonks who are crazy and the Department of Admin who joined us at the table, and I know there are some people here from the Department of Admin, because it really was a coordinated effort determined to make best use of our dollars to really position us in the best way going forward to redesign and reorganize state government. So in keeping with that objective, I'm offering the A9. Since I was elected in 2005, I have been trying to come up with a way to evaluate and investigate how we might better serve the needs of our students with regards to student transportation and lower the overall costs. It seems as though such a big budget area of our education system that has absolutely no impact on student achievement other than peace of mind for families to know that their children are getting to school safely, and that is certainly paramount. But in terms of the actual cost of getting children to and from school and leveraging the opportunity that we have with this student transportation to also provide transit potential partnerships all over the state, particularly in outstate and in more rural areas where transit is pretty difficult to come by. So this amendment simply allows the Department of Admin to contract to do a student transportation study. The study must consider potential efficiencies that could result in employing a regional approach to student transportation. Consideration must be given to potential synergies between general transit and student transportation functions and must include all geographic areas of the state in consideration. And the study would be done at the same time as the other study.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. So at this point, if we add this, we are going to be looking at this is a very specific thing that we're choosing to look at, mm-hmm. but what else will we, the other ones seem much more general.
Right.
And so is that the other ones could be anything, right?
Well, Madam Chairwoman, members, absolutely, they could be whatever it is that this study comes up with. We don't know. We don't want to preordain exactly what it's going to be, and that's why we've crafted the legislation the way we did.
And Madam Chair, the study that Senator Daley is employing is strictly within the confines of state agencies, though. It's all the back office functions of state agencies. This goes beyond state agencies to look at something that our state dollars are used for, but it does not live within state agencies.
We are establishing a quorum. Members are in many other committees this morning. So then this one could look at local transit programs and how they coordinate with school districts.
Exactly.
And the one you have here, Senator Daley, is going to be comparing our programs that we operate within our state agencies with peer groups and world-class organizations to see if they have different ways that they operate that may be more efficient than how we operate. And then they would be able to recommend changes in our operations. And it looks like you have a pretty ambitious schedule here, because by January 15th of next year, they're supposed to submit their report on this along with suggested legislation for implementation. Is that correct?
Madam Chairwoman, it is. One of the concerns that the different committees along the way have had is that we would spend this money, have this study, and do nothing with it. We all agreed we need to do more than just study this. We need to implement the findings and take action. And so if you look at lines 2.8 through 2.10, a plan for implementing the improvement initiatives identified in the benchmarking report and draft legislation that's required to implement those improvements. So we've put that in here to take that next step.
Okay, thank you. We need one more member, and then we can vote on Senator Bonoff's amendment. So, Senator Bonoff, when we look at this, have you already heard about other states that have coordinated school district and public transportation?
Madam Chair, I believe it's Massachusetts that took this on, as well as Colorado. And, in fact, Minnesota is looked at as being very forward-thinking in that we have the cooperative system, but yet we haven't really taken advantage of the co-op system with regard to transportation. So we have our regional co-ops, and they, I'm hoping, would be involved in the study, because they could, in fact, be a clearinghouse for shared service transportation. But, you know, actually, Matt Bailey's here from the department. He may have more insight. But when we talked to Deloitte, when we were looking at shared services back three or four years ago, they identified student transportation as the potentially greatest cost-saving potential.
Would anyone like to testify on the amendment?
No. I guess not.
Madam Chair.
Senator Magnus?
I was just wondering what the cost would be to the amendment.
Senator Madam Bonner? Chair and Senator Magnus, no
that
cost.
That would be included.
In
the $450,000 we're looking at here.
Yes.
Well, Madam Chair, where are we getting the $450,000?
Well, Senator Magnus, we've had some money falling to the bottom line. For example, yesterday in Senator Olson's education bill, there was some money that became available through the actions in that bill. And so we're able to access some of that potentially. Senator Daley, will there be bids let for this study, or what would be the process that we would go through?
I'm under that impression, but it would probably be best to have someone from the Department of Administration speak specifically to that, exactly what they envision.
Is there someone here who could talk about the process?
Madam Chair, members, Matt Bailey, Assistant Commissioner of Administration. Could you say that question again?
I'm wondering about the process, if there would be bids let for the study, or how we would initiate it.
So most other states, or many other states, have used the National Association of State Auditors, Comptrollers, and Treasurers master contract for doing a benchmark. 16 other states have completed benchmarks under that program. It's been publicly procured, so it's a standard piggybacking mechanism that's been used by a lot of states, and that would be an option for us here. We haven't finalized our procurement strategy, but that's an option for us.
Thank you. We do have a quorum. So with that, Senator Bonoff, if you would like to renew your motion on the amendment.
Thank you. I move that the A9 be recommended to pass.
Is there any further discussion on the A9 amendment? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And on the bill, as amended, is there any more discussion about the bill? The Back Office Consolidation Act. Anyone from the audience like to testify for or against? If not, Senator Mino moves that Senate File 933 be recommended to pass as amendment and placed on general orders. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks,
all.
Senator Daley. Next up, we have Senator DeCrise's bill, Senate File 1983. Good morning, Senator DeCrise.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee. Senate File 1983. The bill is intended to remove the statutory requirement that $1.5 million automatically be transferred out of the Department of Labor and Industries Construction Inspection account to the general fund each year. The account is funded by permits issued for construction code and electrical inspections. The funds collected by the state are dedicated to the inspection program. However, these funds were transferred out of the dedicated fund to the general fund in order to help offset the budget deficits of the past two bienniums. For the past two bienniums, the omnibus bills finance bill have, or the omnibus jobs finance bill, have added a $5 surcharge on all construction building permits with the proceeds dedicated to the inspection account so as to help offset the $1.5 million transfer out. The $5 surcharge generates approximately $1.3 million, leaving the account short of funds to carry out the necessary electrical inspections. And if I could, I'd like to introduce the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment will be distributed.
Would you like me to speak to the amendment now? Or wait a minute?
Just wait till a few more members have it in front of them. You may proceed.
The A1 amendment would statutorily set the building permit surcharge at $1 instead of 50 cents, thus avoiding an ongoing need to set the surcharge level at $5 in the omnibus finance bill, which is a session law and expires at the end of each biennium. The total substance of this bill will eliminate the statutory transfer language and set the building permit surcharge at $1, which is a permanent management solution to the problem. This bill will provide sufficient revenues to Dolly to do the required inspections and provide proper enforcement. Creative financing and gimmicks to balance the general budget will be eliminated without creating a tail for the next general fund budget. I ask for your support on this bill.
So, Senator DeCrise, although it looks like in this bill that you're raising the fee, you're actually reducing it by $450. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. The gist of this, when you move each biennium $1.5 million from a fee structured account into the general fund, I believe that to be a tax increase. And it leaves this fund short when it's set in statute. And I do not think that these funds should be rated by statute. They should be we should eliminate that out of statute and leave this fund be whole, but lower the amount coming into it so that it's there's not extra money laying in there to be rated.
So if you have this as a fee, then and it only pays for the services provided, is what you're trying to get at. You're trying to get back down to that.
Yes, Madam Chair. And Bill Swazinski is here, and he can testify to it as well if you'd like.
Mr. Swazinski, we are trying to, Senator Ingebrigtsen, go down to the Judiciary Committee for a vote. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You're okay? All right. He also has an amendment. But Mr. Swazinski.
Madam Chair, members, I think Senator DeKreif did an excellent job of explaining it. You've taken money statutorily out of the fund. You have the 50-cent surcharge in current law, and then you've always added for the last two biennials a $5 surcharge in session law. You don't see it as a result because it's in session law, and that'll be continued. It's a backfill. It's a gimmick in order to fix the management problem for getting the money out in the first place. So this right-sizes the bill, according to the Department of Labor and Industry, for the not the next biennium, but the biennium after. You repeal the statutory language, and you right-size the fund with a $1 surcharge, no tail. It's pretty – that's how it works, and that's the effect of the amendment, Madam Chair, and the total bill. I'll just quickly tell you, this bill is supported by the Minnesota Electrical Association, whom I represent, NECA contractors, CARSA, which is low voltage power limited contractors, Minnesota Alarm and Communication Contractors, the Building Association of Minnesota, and the contract electrical inspectors. There's no opposition that we know of to this bill, and I think the department's comfortable with the language the way it's presented. Thank you, Madam Chair.
The only issue we could have is that we are taking that $1.5 million out of the general fund. And so, in essence, we're reducing our own fund in the out years, but not in the current biennium. And so, members, I just want you to be aware that that's what we're doing. So in the next forecast, they wouldn't be able to count that $1.5 million in the 14-15 biennium.
Madam Chair, I think a slight correction is it doesn't take effect until it's
further out than that. Yes.
Right, so it will not show up as a deficit or deficiency to the general fund. We don't create that tail for next biennium.
Okay.
That's why it's a good bill. There's no tail.
There's no tail showing up in the current fiscal sheets anyway, because we do project out typically 3-4 years. So does everyone understand that? And I think... So on the motion, the A1, Senator Magnus.
You want me to move the amendment? Well, okay, since it's my seat made on the floor, I'll do that. Madam Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment.
Is there anyone who wants to speak for or against the amendment? If not, on Senator Magnus' motion to approve the A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, I would like to offer the A2 amendment, please. Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
If I could start, please, just give a little background. This is pertaining to the fire account special revenue fund. And, Madam Chair and members, in 2006, the legislature established a 0.65% surcharge on premiums for homeowner insurance policies, commercial fire policies, and commercial non-liability insurance policies. The surcharge is deposited in the fire safety account in the special revenue fund, from which $2,268,000 is transferred each year to the general fund to offset the loss of revenue caused by the simultaneous repeal of the one-half of 1% on the fire insurance premium. Chair and members, what this amendment does is I think, hopefully, once and for all, fix this juggling of money for the fire safety account here. The amendment lowers the surcharge on insurance policies, and that's important to remember. It actually lowers the surcharge on insurance policies and creates an open standing appropriation from the fire safety account to fund the state fire marshal and firefighting training and education. Of the amendment, Madam Chair, Section 1 deletes the fire safety account from the statutory list of account replenishment priorities when the state runs a budget surplus. Currently, the fire safety account is the sixth priority following the cash flow account, the budget reserve account, school aids and credits, property tax and aids, and the airport fund. Section 2 reduces the surcharge on homeowner and commercial non-liability insurance policies, as I described before, from 0.65% to 0.5%. This will lower the biannual revenue by approximately $6 million from $26 million to $20 million. Section number 3 of the amendment eliminates the general fund transfer from the fire safety account created by the 2006 legislature to offset the loss of revenue to the general fund when the one-half of 1% tax on fire insurance premiums was repealed in 2006. This will leave a $4.7 million hole in the fiscal year 14 and 15 biennium. Sections 4 and 5 create an open and standing appropriation from the fire safety account to be dedicated as follows. 45%, approximately $9 million, to fund the state fire marshal, and 55%, approximately $11 million, to fund firefighting training and education programs recommended by the Fire Safety Advisory Committee. I would stand for questions.
So, Senator Ingebrigtsen, is just like the electrical fund, this fund was raided because it had a surplus.
That's right.
So the proposal now is to get rid of the surplus and then reduce the rate, the fee, so that we won't be building up such significant surpluses in this, and then making sure that there is an ongoing appropriation for the fire training, and that is what we're attempting to do here. I mean, as far as our committee goes, too, we're looking at reducing the fee that is charged to all homeowners on their insurance, and I suppose all businesses, everybody who has property tax insurance or property insurance. And then we are giving them a standing appropriation, which is something we don't always do, but it is allowing the fee to be used for its purpose. And so they would always have it available. And, you know, the only issue that we could have is that it would still raise more money than anticipated and maybe more than they need or what we think they might need. So that's the only issue about giving it the standing appropriation. And I don't know if members want to talk about that a little more or not. But we are trying not to use this fee or surcharge for other purposes than what we intended it for when it was established number of years ago. Correct, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yeah, Madam Chair, you described it absolutely perfectly. It's just constantly a football back and forth as to whether we take from this account or allow the firefighters a permanent stream of dollars. That will do this. And will also reduce, as you said, reduce the surcharge that's collected on our homeowners as well as business insurance policies, so fire insurance policies. So it's certainly a step in the right direction and eliminating the process of them having to come back every year. But, Madam Chair, I do have a technical amendment on line 2.5, if I could. The year 2012, first year 2000 through June of 2012 should be changed to June of 2013.
Yeah.
He's sitting in for Senator Higgins on that oral amendment. She would have picked that up, I'm sure, if she was here. It was just a typo.
I will incorporate that into your amendment, Senator Ingebrigtsen. So if members have noted that on 2.5, where it says 212, change it to 2013. I think the only question I have is, when we set this rate originally, I don't think we really anticipated it would raise this much revenue. And so we have had surpluses in the fund, as the sheet indicates, from the summary that we have here, to the point right now that there's over $5 million sitting in the surplus account, even after we take out money. the only issue I have is that if we give them this much money now, and we reduce the rate, I don't know what the anticipated amount of the annual appropriation will be. And I'm wondering if we should have a standing appropriation, because then we may not be reviewing it. That's my only issue, is if we shouldn't look at it again, because this is unknown how much revenue this will generate. And yep. So I don't know if Senate Council would have any suggestions of how we would take out the standing appropriation, just to, so that it would, we'd still have to look at it, because it's a change that is new and probably needs to be reviewed before we move ahead. Senator Ingraham.
Madam Chair, would it be just as very simple as going with the current amendment here? I certainly understand the reason why the insurance was bringing in an unusual amount of money, because properties at that time, I think when the bill was passed, properties, it's fair to say, were increasing in value. Consequently, the insurance cost per year for insurance on those homes was also increasing, so that created more money, obviously, in the account because of the percentage. I would have to, I think I can, wouldn't be going too far into the weeds to say that those same properties now are devaluating in the current system that we're in, and you're going to see a reduction probably in this. And I think that's what your concern is, that it might not be enough. Is that?
No, Senator Ingraham, I think it'll be an adequate amount, yeah, because we've had way more than we've needed. I'm thinking it still might be too much.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Studzinski?
If I can weigh into this, I'm Bill Studzinski, and I represent the fire chiefs, the fire marshals, the fire departments association, the arson investigators as well. And this is a number one priority for the fire service. Why it looks like you have a surplus in the past is because the money has never been reappropriated by the legislature, because it's like the dedicated account, just like the one you just dealt with for the electrical fund. So it looks like a surplus, but really hasn't been, because the need is clearly there. We've been trying last biennium again to get the money into the training fund and everything else, but you have to actually make the appropriation. So by going to an open standing account, you don't have to make the appropriation each year. It's collected for this purpose, to fund the fire marshal's office, the hazmat teams, and what have you, and the chemical assessment teams, the structural collapse teams, and training for all volunteer fire departments throughout the state of Minnesota. And that's why the need is there. But then you would no longer have to appropriate the money each biennium. It'll be used specifically for the purposes as authorized in the amendment laid out under this structure and the percentages breakdown. We did agree to provide the reduction in the fee. We think it right sizes that as well going forward. We work with the Insurance Federation, at least, and we visit with them extensively on that, and they're quite comfortable with all of this. So we deeply appreciate Senator Ingebrigtsen bringing this amendment forward. I think it right sizes it. And it's always been confusing to say, because it looks like a surplus. There's a surplus because you have not appropriated the money to the fire training and whatever the legislature has in the last biennium, and two bienniums, in fact. So it's always been short. So that's my two cents on this one. I don't know of any opposition to it. It just it provides a permanent solution to this management problem as well, just much like the other bill.
Sir Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my guess would be is that this is certainly going to be looked at and watched on a yearly basis by both the fire folks as well as the insurance industry. So I would venture to guess if this thing gets to be too much or not enough, there's going to be people that would readdress it in a future legislature. But if this thing is, I mean, it really certainly behooves us if there's getting to be what we think is too much money there. I don't want to put money out there to training and just have them burn that up. That's kind of a pun, by the way. Burn up the fire safety account just because the money's there. I mean, we can't get into that. When we shouldn't be doing that. And at any given time, I'm thinking we could certainly come back and change this, as well as, again, if there's too much money in there, we could actually lower that rate again. So I don't think there's anything stopping us from doing that.
The only issue I have is once they start getting that much, they'll always think they need that much, and it would be harder to, I mean, it could go up. It will, as property values restore themselves and go up. Of course, and it's not even the fact that the property values have gone down, but they base their premiums on the cost of replacement, I think, if they had to replace the properties. And sometimes the new construction costs are more expensive than the actual value of the home if it were to be sold today.
Right. But Madam Chair, we certainly have not resisted the cash laying there when we needed it either, and we have taken and robbed from that account as well. And I know that went on at least in two bienniums that I was involved in because of the shortage. And thank goodness it was there because we were able to help balance that budget. But so we have it has gone both ways. But I think it's something that the market will take care of itself. And again, if they're getting to be too much money there, I think there will be an indication somewhere that we can deal with that. So, but they should have some standing, I would say some standing funding when they're having a hard time retaining volunteer fire department's members, which I think all but just a handful in the state of Minnesota are all volunteer throughout the whole state, even down in the metro. There isn't very many full-time funded fire departments in the state, and the retention, of course, and of young firemen now is getting to be very challenging, as well as emergency services of all sorts of types of things. So,
Senator Magnus?
Madam Chair, maybe one thing we could take a look at is requiring a report from the Commissioner of Public Safety to the ranking members of the chairman and ranking members of the Judiciary Committee, maybe also the Finance Committee, Madam Chair. If we are, that's one potential solution when we're changing the rates here to get a handle on the rate. So you could require a report and maybe do it for a couple bienniums and see how this sorts out. I don't know how this is reported now. I think the department was here, but whether they're just reporting to the Judiciary Committee in our case and Public Safety in the House or who's watching this, so we can kind of keep a handle on just what the proper rate is. Because I agree with Senator Ingebretson. I think this is a good endeavor, and I certainly with all the volunteer fire departments out there, we want to make sure everyone's got adequate resources there to do the job. But still, I think it's our responsibility, of course, to manage the funds properly. So we could add a report requirement in there.
By my chair. Yeah.
Or you could do a sunset and then review it, or however you wish to do it. Those are two ways to do it.
Right. Or we could simply not have it as a standing appropriation. And then it would have to come back before the legislature. Because right now they're receiving almost $3 million for fire service training. And this provision from the projections that I'm reading would raise it to $11 million a biennium. That is a very big increase. It's almost a three times. Three times more than they get nearly. So maybe we need to look at the rates a little more. Because we're still going to be generating potentially more than necessary. I mean, if we give them $11 million, they'll spend $11 million. But I don't know if that's critical to have that much or
Madam
not.
Madam Chair, that's why I was suggesting a report. So someone is looking at the fund and seeing, is the money being spent properly? Do they have adequate? Is that the proper rate? So that's why I'm suggesting a report, Senator Ingebretson.
Madam Chair, if I might, I would also suggest not only the Public Safety Judiciary Committee, but also your committee.
Yeah.
Obviously, you'd be one that they should report to, and the folks that are working with the financing in the Senate would certainly know that if anything's out of kilter. And I agree, Senator. Senator Roebling, that if we need to look at the insurance, the percentages of the insurance, then we should do that. But I think a 1 or 2 year trial period here with an end date for reconsideration. Maybe Mr. Bonner can tell us whether that's done or how it's done. Or familiar with that at all?
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the on the summary sheet that was handed out under Section 3, is that the last sentence there? It says that this will leave a $4.7 million hole in 14 and 15. Is that the general fund that they're referring to?
Mr. Turner, would you like to address that?
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, when they created the fund in 2006, the fire marshal at that time was funded on a general fund, as a general fund appropriation. But traditionally, going back about 70 years, we've had a one-half of 1% tax on fire insurance premiums. When we repealed that tax, and that tax flowed into the general fund, and then we had a general fund appropriation to fund the fire marshal. When they created the fire service or fire safety account, we repealed that tax, and that that tax was bringing in about $2.2 million a year to the general fund. So we set up a general fund statute or a general fund transfer in statute to make up for that lost tax, and that comes right out of the fire safety account. So it's kind of a continuation of a general fund shift that's been going on for many, many, many years. And if we go to this amendment, that shift, that transfer, which is in the forecast, will no longer be there, and it comes to about $4.7 million a biennial.
Senator Stump?
Madam Chair and Mr. Turner, that half a percent tax, that wasn't a stable dollar amount, or didn't generate a stable dollar amount. According to my understanding, it was a growth, and it's one of the few things that where there's been general growth over the history of that insurance tax, or I guess it would be tax on insurance policies. So when it was $2.5 million, was that at a given year?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, that's my understanding. You probably have a much longer history with this than I do with this issue.
Just from my information, I mean, it doesn't take too much effort to realize that, you know, every year we add real estate property in the state of Minnesota, and some years values go up. So when you tax that, you obviously have growth. And, you know, I think the I would tend to agree with the chair on the approach. You know, this would be kind of the ultimate lights on bill for that area of our for those efforts. And I'm not opposed, definitely support the volunteer firefighters and the training and everything, but it just seems like once the economy starts turning around, which it is, I mean, there's more construction, and obviously if we pass a stadium bill and a big bonding bill, we're going to have even more construction and more fire insurance policies to tax. And so all that growth is going to go into that fund, and it just seems like there has to be a kind of a constant monitor, I think, to watch and, you know, be aware just of what's going on. So,
Madam Chair, if I can just interject one thought, and I'll be very brief. Mr. Turner's correct. It was a tax and went into the general fund. But then out of the general fund, you funded the fire marshal's office historically. That's what you've done for all the years back when I was doing the state budgets in 1973. But what the fire safety account did is repealed the tax, created a surcharge on insurance policies provides funding, and the fire safety account now funds the fire marshal's office. The general fund doesn't. I mean, that's, money goes into this account to fund the fire marshal's office, and now also to fund, and to fund training as well. But training is not just training for the 18,000 volunteer firefighters. It's training for the professional firefighters as well, and there's a few thousand of those, and also provides training for the hazmat teams and the collapse teams, structural collapse teams. It's a very sophisticated business nowadays, and there's a tremendous need. We have a need for a lot more money in excess of that, but this is why this approach was taken to permanently fund the fire marshal's office under this appropriation, and certainly we don't have any trouble with you taking a look at it. We agreed to reduce the fee that's collected now. And we did put together a master plan with the Department of Public Safety showing measurable outcomes and how this will be worked. And it's and that's why the Department of Public Safety signed off on this. And I believe this recommendation is also this fix is an appropriation is also in the governor's budget. Because it makes a permanent solution. And I know the governor's supplemental budget did recommend funding this. Actually, because you have to appropriate the money for the training purposes to begin with. And that's always been the problem. Historically, since this account has been in existence. But keep in mind, there's no tax, we're reducing the fee, and you are funding the fire marshal's office out of there. Besides, you were transferring money out of this account to the general fund again, so the general fund was a pretty big winner for a number of years. So that's the quick and dirty background on it, Madam Chair. So
I think we're looking at, I feel not as comfortable leaving a standing appropriation, though. Just because of the potential growth in the fund, I think that we probably should have this back before the legislature for them to appropriate funding. If it were a flat amount of money, it would be one thing, but we don't know where the growth will take us, and I think that we should be appropriating it as we see it coming in. And of course, I think that if there's too much money, we continue to reduce the fee. Right. But I'm afraid that if we say it's a standing appropriation, we'll never get to that point. We know that they have a great lobbying force. And if they come in and say, we need this money for training, we've come to expect it and depend on it, and then it's hard to change it later on. So I hesitate to just leave it a standing appropriation. I think Mr. Bodden would have a suggestion on how we could do that.
Madam Chair and members, you'd need to do several things with Section 5 on page 3 of the amendment. The first, to remove the statutory coding, since this would be a one-time appropriation. Delete page 3, lines 1 and 2. And then on line 3, delete subdivision 1A and insert section 5. And then on page 3, line 3, delete paren A, close paren. Then on page 3, line 9, after the period, insert this is a one-time appropriation. And I'm not sure, Madam Chair, if you did want language directing a study or rather a report from the Commissioner of Public Safety.
Mr. Bonner, I think that might be appropriate.
Okay, that
just
can,
so we get an idea of what the new fee is generating.
So then, Madam Chair, the suggestion I have for you on that same line, add a sentence that says, by January 15th, 2014, the commissioner shall report to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over the fire safety account regarding the balances and uses of the account. And then on page 3, delete lines 10 through 16.
So this would provide us with a one-time appropriation now, a report so we know where that money goes and how much money is in the account, and take out the standing appropriation. Is that correct?
Correct.
What's the report due January 2014?
Which is pretty close to what the governor was proposing. He was proposing to give the fire for fire training $4.5 million. but I don't know that he was going to reduce the rate in his proposal. But he wanted to make the appropriation. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, what's the bottom dollar? What gets appropriated then for the fire training? I'm not understanding. Under this new proposal.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, it's my understanding that now Section 5 would be appropriating the surplus, which is $5 million, I believe, according to Mike, $5.4 million, 5.5. And I'm wondering whether or not the governor was going to appropriate $4.5 million from the surplus for fire training purposes. If I'm reading this correctly, 45% of that surplus now will go to the fire marshal and only 55% for fire training. So it'd be 55% of the 5.4 million, so it'd be what?
300,000, I think it was.
Yeah.
300,000 more.
3 million.
The consolidation but studies or whatever.
It'd be like three million going for training and 2 million going to the fire marshal, and I don't see why the fire marshal needs $2 million more.
That is correct. It's a good catch. We probably need to change it. Since we took out the standing appropriation, too, we're working. This was a House amendment that came forward, and might want to change that. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Madam Chair, I guess I'm gonna speak against your idea here, your amendment, if it's an amendment form. I don't see any reason why. I don't care how strong their lobby is. We've taken from that account over the last years, and their strong lobby didn't prevent us from doing that. Their strong lobby certainly is not going to prevent us from looking at the insurance companies and saying, we really need to reduce these rates because we're getting too much money into this fire account. I just don't think, you know, that's certainly our responsibility. They should appreciate that. They should know that. And if they can't appreciate that, well, then I'm not sure what we do, but it's still our responsibility. And I know this was a situation that was worked out in the House. They don't want to come back and fight with us every year, and that's what this was intended to fix. And I guess I would still like to do that. And I think Senator Magnus had a great idea to report back in 2 years and maybe review it in 2 years, and maybe we can actually just implement this law for a period of one biennium and have to come back at that time to deal with it. And maybe then we would have a better idea. But if they're going to get $12 million this year when they've only been getting three or four, we can certainly monitor that. They've been getting by with a lot less, so it behooves us then at that point to start thinking about the homeowner and their insurance that they're paying. So I just don't think we can't make that decision at a later date.
Mr. Turner, though we obviously have some language changes that we'd have to make, so the fire marshal's office doesn't get three times more money, too.
Madam Chair, members, we have to remember we're talking about the current biennium, which is where when the surplus exists, and then future bienniums. And the 45-55 split, 45 comes out to about $9 million a year to the fire marshal. That's about the fire marshal's base right now, a little bit more. And then the $11 million towards fire training. But now this biennium, everything has already been appropriated. The fire marshal is fully funded. So I don't see why there should be an allocation for the surplus in this biennium to the fire marshal, unless I'm reading this incorrectly.
Okay. I'm going to have our fiscal analyst explain the options that we could do here.
Madam Chair, members, to Mr. Turner's point, fiscal 13, 12 and 13 appropriations were made as part of the biennial budget enacted last July. The amendment, if it were to be changed as Mr. Bodner described, would be an allocation in fiscal 14 based on the ending balance at the end of this biennium. The governor's recommendation was a one-time increase of $4.5 million, which speaks to the latter part of that paragraph, distributed according to the recommendations of the advisory committee. So the one option would be to appropriate money from the fund, or from the account, I'm sorry, in fiscal 13, as the governor recommended. An alternative would be to, in fiscal 14, allocate the projected $5.5 million surplus on a 55-45 basis, on a one-time basis, or the language as it was initially proposed in the base amendment would be an open and standing appropriation that, as Mr. Turner said, leaves the fire marshal base going from about $8.5 million to $9 million, and fire safety training going from about $3 million to $11 million in perpetuity as a, as an open and standing appropriation, instead of part of the biennial budget appropriations process as it has been since 2006.
Senator Ingebrigtsen and I obviously are not in agreement on this, because my preference would be to continue to have an appropriation. Only because of the unknown amount, but I know the House has this current, the language we're looking at now, the House has, and I wonder if we couldn't amend this and then go through discussions with the House on which would be the preferred method. It would give us a little more time, too, to decide which method, or if there should be some kind of a hybrid method put in place instead, so that there could be a standing appropriation for some of the money, but that the fire marshal's office would get this, would go on through an appropriation like all the other state agencies, which I think would and should be appropriate. It would be unusual to separate them from going through the same budgeting process as everybody else. So perhaps,
Madam Chair, is the distinct difference between them and everybody else is that there's a special tax that's coming in to fund that that.
The fire marshal's office. Right.
So it does create a little difference there, but Madam Chair, if you're okay with that and going into a committee and looking at something, conference committee, is that the intention here?
That is the intention.
To fix it, I'm fine with that.
Actually, this is attached to a different bill in the House, and I wanted it brought into the finance committee to have some discussion about it before we'd have to negotiate with the House on it, because if the Senate hadn't seen it, I don't know that we would have been able to accept it, but there certainly are provisions in here that I think we should move. But I just want to make sure that we're doing it in a way that will take us into the future and be financially responsible. So I would like to take out the standing appropriation. So I would like to offer the oral amendment that Mr. Bodern offered to Senator Ingebrigtsen's amendment. And I don't know, should we adopt his amendment and then amend it, or what's the best way to do it? Okay, we could do this amendment first.
Madam Chair, is this, if I could, just one real quick question. Just for this coming funding that we're doing, it's going to, the bill in its form here is going to give the fire training service some more money. And how much is it according to Mr. Bonner's, or excuse me, Mr. Gustafson's thought here? Is it going to be what the governor's proposal was?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, as I understand what Mr. Bonner described, it would be a difference in amount and timing from what the governor recommended. The governor recommended a one-time fiscal 13 appropriation of $4.5 million. The language in the potentially amended Section 5 would be looking at the balance at the end of this biennium, So on the last day of fiscal 13, instead of an appropriation for fiscal 13, on the last day of fiscal 13, to look at that balance, projected to be $5.5 million, and to allocate it on a 45-55 basis, so it would be approximately $2.5 million of that would go to the state fire marshal, $3 million would go to the fire safety, the advisory committee recommendations for firefighter training education programs. So it would be a difference in the fiscal year and a difference in an amount from what the governor's supplemental budget recommended.
So, Mr. Gustafson, how would we adjust that so the state fire marshal's office did not receive that much additional revenue? I don't know that they've even requested it. Senator Magnus?
Madam Chair, you could say in the first, if the issue is to get the firefighters training, $4 million, In 2014, you could specify that out as a percentage or whatever, and then from thereafter, distribute it at whatever rate Senator Ingebretson is thinking here. Is the 45-55 the rate then? But to get them the $4 million the first year, I think is what Senator Ingebretson's looking at.
So that was Senator Ingebretson's original bill for $4.5 million.
Mr. Turner might have an idea.
Mr. Turner,
Madam Chair, members, I'd like Senate Counsel to listen to this too. I was thinking, since the fire marshal's already got its appropriation for this biennium, couldn't the committee just on line 3.5? Delete to be allocated as follows: 45% of the unallocated balance for the state fire marshal division and 55. Okay, and then just so it would read is, okay, the balance is appropriated to the commissioner of public safety to be distributed according to the recommendations of the advisory committee. That would give the trainers the entire $5.4 million, and it would cut the fire marshal out, I think.
That would be just for this year.
Just for this biennium, yes.
Because they're already funded.
Yes.
And that's a projection, as that $5.46 million will be remaining in the account at the end of the biennium.
Yes.
I mean, there's no
it's not
certainty at all, but that is a projection.
Madam Chair, that certainly seems reasonable to me.
Oh, Mr. Gustafson is pointing out, though, if we wait till the end, they don't get it next year. If we wait till the end of the fiscal cycle. So we could actually just do an appropriation, as your original bill had in it, of $4.5 million for next year. And they'd have that immediately instead of waiting until the end.
That would certainly be my.
That was what you started with,
support,
Senator Ingebretson.
Yes. Yeah.
But I do think we should keep the rate reduction in here because we're just generating too much revenue.
I'm all for the rate reduction. I'm all for it. Yeah.
We're taking it for something that it wasn't, necessarily intended for. In some ways, it was, but we are adequately funding the fire marshal's office. It was for that purpose that the fee was increased and for fire safety training. And so we have been generating more money than we need.
So, Madam Chair, I might ask then, what would be your suggestion that I do then? Can we fix it in this bill, that $4.5 million appropriation?
Mr. Bonner, do you have ideas
this amendment
on that?
Madam Chair, the question I have, first of all, is one of timing. The way this works right now, as Mr. Gustafson pointed out, the money would be available basically in fiscal 14. It's collected on June 30th, 2013. Is the wish to provide funding in fiscal 13? If so, I think we need to change the timing provided on line 3.3.
I believe that is our wish.
So on line 3.3, you could delete 2013 and insert 2012, which would collect the unallocated balance in the fire safety account at the end of the current fiscal year. And then I'm not sure, I'll defer to the fiscal analyst as far as the dollar amount that might be available if that is done. But if you want to make that available solely for firefighter training, then this section can be reworded so that it would read, is appropriated to the Commissioner of Public Safety for the recommendations of the advisory committee under subdivision 2 for the Board of Firefighter Training and Education, et cetera. Basically, you would, on line 3.4, on line 3.5, delete everything after safety, delete line 3.6, and on line 3.7, before the first the, insert 4. Again, I can't speak to the dollar amount that would be available, but that would capture the unallocated balance at the end of this fiscal year and make it available for training in fiscal 13.
Since we're doing this in the middle of a biennium, I don't know that we should completely empty the fund. So I still am thinking we should put a dollar amount of 4.5 in. So after, on June 30th, 2012, 4.5 million in the fire safety account is appropriated to the Commissioner of Public Safety. I think that would probably be the best route to go. If we're doing it in the middle of the biennium, so we don't empty out the reserve and have a shortfall at some point. Mr. Bonney.
Madam Chair, you might want to say not to exceed $4.5 million. If there's a smaller amount available for some reason, you wouldn't want to appropriate money that doesn't exist. So on line 3.4, after the second comma, insert not to exceed $4.5 million. Comma.
Okay. So then it would say on June 30th, 2012, any
unallocated balance in the fire safety account under 297.9.06 sub 3, comma, not to exceed 4.5 million is appropriated to the Commissioner of Public Safety for the recommendations of the advisory committee under sub 2, et cetera. And then we'll have a sentence. I'm assuming we're including the language that was offered previously. This is a one-time appropriation. And it would also have the language directing the report from the Commissioner of Public Safety. And you would delete paragraph B if we're combining all of this.
Madam Chair, are we not Senator right Ingram. Where we started?
No. I think it's
a good idea. I'm certainly very on board with your idea of if this thing changes and there gets to be a lot of money, I understand that, and maybe this is one way to resolve it, to get it into that conference committee and put together, as you call it, a hybrid. So I'm fine.
So I would like to offer the oral amendment to Senator Ingebrigtsen's amendment. Is there any further discussion about it? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. And then Senator Ingebrigtsen's amendment, which does reduce the rate also, so that the fund doesn't build up to the levels that it has in the past. So any discussion on Senator Ingebrigtsen's motion? If not, all in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying A2 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And so now we have it attached to Senator DeKreif's bill, having to do with the electrical inspectors, which is also making sure that the revenue that is intended for a purpose, what we are collecting it for, is really going to go for that purpose and not for other general fund purposes. So it does affect tails in the future, but at some point in time, we need to correct it. So we might as well do it now. We're putting it out, in your case, a little further, but it is something that needs to happen. And so it'll be projected in the forecasts in the future. Any other questions about that? Anyone who wants to testify for or against the combined bill? If not, Senator Ingebertson moves that Senate File 1983, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on general orders. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Just a second, Senator Gazelka. Senator Perry, do you have to leave? Senator, thank you for your patience, Senator Gazelka. Senator Perry has to go to another location, so we're hoping we can take his up quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before you now is Senate File 1832. It's the Help America Vote Act. And you can see that what we've done here, excuse me, has kind of dedicated some of the federal monies to certain items that you can see on lines 1.9 through 1.3, $50,000 for military and overseas empowerment act compliance, $120,000 for support of the local election officials, $50,000 for eligibility notification letters to felons if required by law. And then $1.2 million is appropriated in fiscal year 2013 to the Secretary of State from the account established. This is the bill that we have before us. I know there are some differences in the House, but we have not really come to any conclusion with the House at this point in time. I've been talking with some of the other members and some of our members, and there's differences so much that the House in theirs, they do not specifically earmark some of this money, and some of our members have great concern about that. And so I guess, Madam Chair, my thought is that we move this bill, and ultimately it ends up in a conference committee, and we can air these issues out before it comes back to the floor.
Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, so with regard to the amendment that we passed off the floor on voter ID, and so much of that was vague in terms of how much was left to the next legislature, and so as I recall in much of the conversation, costs couldn't really be identified because we didn't really know what the next legislature will do with that. Can you explain to me how the money that you have assigned in this bill relates to the kind of gray murkiness of what's going to happen with regard to the next legislative session's enactment of if should that pass?
Senator Perry?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonoff, I think the big issue that we were discussing on the floor was how much was it going to take?
Right.
And that's why at one point we discussed lowering the amount for the HAVA funds at this point until we found out if in fact, that amendment would pass this November. And what I'm doing here is accepting Secretary Ritchie's request. Beth, we could have Beth come up if she would like to tackle that question. But that seems to be the big unknown. What will it take to handle that if that amendment should pass? Would you want to?
So, Senator Bonner, just follow up, Madam Chair and Senator Perry. So, basically, the Secretary of State and Beth and Ms. Frazier, you can address this. They're suggesting that, in fact, we plan for the potential passage, should it pass, and identify money rather than be looking for this money next year. Could you address that?
Ms. Frazier?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Frazier from the Office of the Secretary of State. And our office has requested $1.425 million out of the Help America Vote Act Fund to help finish the local election officials finish redistricting and to provide support to them in the presidential election this year.
Oh.
Last year, the Senate appropriated the full amount of Help America Vote Act funds that we needed for the full biennium, but over the summer in the final negotiations, we were basically only given 1 year's appropriation. And so we've come back and asked for basically a second year's appropriation. Each year, going back to at least 2004, the office has spent about $1.2 million on primarily supporting the statewide voter registration system, which is the tool that the local election officials use for voter registrations, for printing rosters, for administering absentee balloting. And in addition, this bill included about $200,000 for a bill that Senator Chamberlain was carrying related to preventing felons from voting. Unfortunately, that bill didn't meet deadline. So the our request is basically for $1.2 million for supporting the statewide voter registration system and other efforts. This bill at this point has earmarked 1.2 of it for implementation of the proposed constitutional amendment were it to pass. And we believe that it's going to take significantly more money than that to implement that amendment were it to pass, probably tens of millions of dollars. But even the voter education piece in last year's bill was $2.7 million. So no matter what, it's going to take more than 1.2 and more than is actually left in the Help America Vote Act account. There's only $1.8 million left in that account. So were that amendment to pass, the legislature is going to have to find other money anyway.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair and Ms. Frazier and Senator Perry, now this is it was starting to be clear in your testimony when you were saying, well, no, this isn't for the potential passage or not passage of the voter ID. It's really just general needs that the Secretary of State's office needs to accomplish this. And yet then you finished your testimony by saying that Senator Perry is identifying this same 1.2 that you've said you need just for day-to-day operations, et cetera, and that Senator Perry is earmarking them, in your words, for implementing voter photo identification requirements. So what is that?
Well,
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, you're correct. If, in fact, it passes, that money will be there. I contend that if it doesn't pass, the money's going to be there anyway. So it will have to come back and reallocate or redesignate what that money can be used for.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, it might be, would you consider not then, it sounds like this 1.2 is really for the general needs of the Secretary of State's office. So the on lines 1.14, for implementing voter photo identification requirements as enacted by law, when we haven't yet, in fact, identified how it is going to be implemented by law because we were waiting to see what happened with that ballot language. So it seems to me that's premature. Why wouldn't you just end the act at the period and delete that part of the sentence?
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, because I my intent here is to make sure if that does pass, mm-hmm. that there's money to start with, and I believe 1.2 from speaking with others that's a good starting point. Plus, I believe by earmarking we have dollars available for the Secretary to use at this point in time.
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, Ms. Frazier, has the governor's office or anyone else weighed in on that language in this way in this bill?
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, no, I don't believe that the governor's office has weighed in this way. The House language is substantially different, and although this doesn't allocate the money in the way that we would most prefer, we do want to see this move forward so that there can potentially be an agreement with the House.
Senator Stump, did you have a comment or question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do. Who usually the process for notifying felons is generally not done by the Secretary of State's office, is it?
Ms. Frazier?
Isn't it done through the election judges?
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, there isn't a good uniform procedure statewide for ensuring that people convicted of felonies know throughout their entire sentence that they're not allowed to vote. And the Governor's Task Force on Election Integrity, on which Senators Sieben and Chamberlain sit, came up with a series of recommendations. And one of the recommendations was to have the Department of Corrections provide our office with a list of people who are currently serving felony sentences and to send them a letter prior to each state general election, just reminding them, you're still serving your sentence, you're not supposed to vote, we know you're not supposed to vote, which we think would serve as a real deterrent and a reminder that people aren't supposed to do that. Unfortunately, that legislation did not receive a hearing in the Judiciary Committee, and so it didn't meet deadline.
So, Madam Chair, the $50,000, that's what that's for. That's
Madam
to
Chair,
the
Senator,
Secretary
yes.
of State? Okay. And then the $50,000 for the Military and Overseas Empowerment Act, what is that?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, that's federal legislation that was passed in 2009, I believe. And that those funds help us support a website that we have specifically for military and overseas voters. It also helps us support the sending absentee ballots to military and overseas voters electronically, and the part of the statewide voter registration system that supports that work.
Ms. Fraser, you get an appropriation from the legislature to operate your office. So when you indicated that there's additional funding needed, and I know you took a budget cut like all of us did, but this money is not typically available. I mean, this is probably the end of it, and it won't be an ongoing appropriation from the federal government. So how have you planned for not having it? Would you be looking for a bigger budget next year, or what will fill this hole if this HAVA money is not available?
Madam Chair and members, the Help America Vote Act funds have subsidized the Secretary of State's budget going back to about 2004. And as the money runs out, we will be in conversation with you all about an increase to our base, because we do need about $1.2 million each calendar year, each fiscal year, in order to support the statewide voter registration system and the local election officials.
Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair, Ms. Fraser, I understand that from your earlier comments that there's about $1.8 million in the fund now.
Madam
and
Chair,
so
Senator,
this,
that's
with
right.
this spending, Madam Chair, $1.4 million, it'll leave about $400,000 left then. So.
Ms. Fraser?
Yes. Okay. Madam Chair, Senator.
Thank you.
And there's no deadline for when you have to spend it? It doesn't have to be repaid or anything?
Madam Chair, no, it doesn't have to be repaid.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langseth.
As I understand with the felons voting, they have served their sentence, but they are still classified as felons, and many of them actually thought they could vote, being that, you know, they were out of prison and so on. But there is a very good database of those people, right? So it really seems to me like we should be able to take care of that one without too much problem, particularly from the Secretary of State's office. And because how many are there? Wasn't it a little over 100 or something like that they felt had voted that shouldn't have been voting?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Stump, there is a database that the Department of Corrections has that includes everyone who's currently serving a felony sentence. Unfortunately, at this point, our office does not have access to that data. The Department of Corrections provides us with data before elections, but it's only for people who are under the commissioner's jurisdiction, which are people that have actually served time in prison, which is only about 20% of the population. So part of the bill that unfortunately didn't meet deadline would have given us access to that data so that we could have used it to flag people so to prevent them from voting and, if need be, catch them if they do vote. I do believe that there were a little over 100 people who have been convicted for having voted in the past few elections.
Well, Madam Chair, Why can't we just amend this bill to do whatever that other bill was supposed to do? I mean, what's wrong with that?
You know, Senator Limmer might have a little problem with that. But, you know, I guess if we want to notify people, we have to have the information to notify them.
Yeah.
So, Ms. Fraser, how many people will you be able to notify with this 50,000 if you don't have the entire list? Will you have enough of a list to notify those who are likely to vote? They're out on release, but supervised release?
Madam Chair, we don't have the authority to use the data in that way. And so we, under current law, I don't believe would be able to notify anyone, send a letter to anyone that to remind them that they're not allowed to vote. That was part of the legislation, was giving us the authority to use the data in that way.
So in order to have that happen, we would have to get the rest of that bill and attach it to here so you could actually expend this money. Otherwise, would you have to give them, could you give the money to the corrections department and have them send the letters out?
Madam Chair, I don't know if they have the authority to send that. I don't know.
Because they have the list, so the data privacy issue wouldn't be a problem for them. But then they would have to initiate the action with the funding.
Right. Madam Chair, part of that bill was going to provide some funding for them to ensure that they could extract the needed data and provide it to us. And so I don't know, without that sort of funding, whether they would have the resources necessary to do this sort of mailing or not.
Madam Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, is that data private data? It would seem to me that the most efficient way would be if you have names and addresses that you could mail something to, you would also know what precinct they're in, and would there be any way that in the lists that the local people use at their election that there could be these folks, if they do come to either vote or attempt to register to vote, are ineligible to vote, and just put them with the lists that are used at the election site. I think, you know, the just relying on sending a letter and saying you're not eligible, I'm not sure what that accomplishes. Some might not, and we haven't gotten at the true point. If they're not eligible to vote, then they shouldn't be allowed to vote when they come there. And it wouldn't have to be a terribly big fuss made of that. But electronically, it seems that we would have that capability. Is there a data privacy issue that would not allow somebody who is a convicted felon that is not known or isn't available for that purpose?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we do, if the person is registered to vote, we do flag their registration. So if they come in, the election judges know that there's a question about their eligibility. There is not currently authorization to provide that data to the polling places. And I think that that's an issue that would really need to be looked at, because there are so many, for example, Jim Johnsons in the state, that even if we believed that Jim Johnson, you know, lives in this precinct, it might be hard to... it might be hard for election judges on election day to know, is this the right Jim Johnson or not? Representative Mike Nelson said that he door knocked 7 Mike Nelsons in his district. And so, I mean, we do have an issue with some common names. But I think that's an issue worth exploring. It's just a question of how exactly it could work. But there's currently not authorization to provide that data to the polling places.
I do think that a letter would be pretty significant, because if you warn them that it's another felony, correct, right, to vote when they're not supposed to, most of them probably don't want to pile that on to their current record. So if they were able to be reached with a letter, I think that would prevent them from voting. I think most of them just didn't know, weren't aware that because they're out of prison, they feel that they have their rights restored and it hasn't been made clear to them, perhaps. So, Senator Stump?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I totally agree with Senator Bonhoeff on this last line on 1.14, that the language after act is not meaningful and in a sense useless until we have any outcome of what happens in the election. I mean, we don't really appropriate money on assumption. We usually have some rationale for it. Maybe not all the time, but sometime. So I don't know if Senator Bonhoff wants to move it or what, but I think that...
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, you go for it.
Well, I would just move to delete the after act through the end of the sentence.
So it would be for no purpose that they would get the extra 1.2. It's not specified. It would just be a general purpose.
Well, it sounds as if the Secretary of State has requested money to, I'm not sure, how would you spend the 1.2?
Ms. Fraser?
Well, you did mention it before.
Your budget.
Yeah, that's their budget. Yeah. So
I believe HAVA has some limitations on it already. I'm not sure what those are.
Madam Chair and members, the 1.2 does have to be spent in accordance with both the Help America Vote Act and the Help America Vote Act state plan that was put together by Secretary Kiffmeyer when the act was originally passed. And the vast majority of the funds would be spent on maintaining the statewide voter registration system and the election reporting system, which is what allows us to post results on election night and make sure that local election officials can easily upload data to that system. We would use a portion of the money for data verification and matching, in addition to the money we'd hope to use for the bill that isn't moving forward for felons. We do have some existing data matching with the Department of Corrections. We have an annual contract with the Division of Vehicle Services for nightly verification of voter data. Data matching related to non-citizen data we get from the Department of Public Safety, Department of Health, about deaths, the courts, about felons and those who have had their rights taken away. We do data matching with the National Change of Address Database to update voter registrations as people move. We have staff dedicated to supporting local election officials, being there to walk them through the steps they need to take to use the system and print rosters and process the data. We need to monitor and work with the counties on reporting the Help America Vote Act funds that they have in their possession. And we do voter outreach and education and are statutorily required to have a voter hotline right before the election to answer voter questions. So those are the ways that we would plan on using those funds.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, so based on that, it seems as though deleting that part actually has more integrity because that is how the funds are going to be used. They're not going to be used to implement voter photo identification requirements as enacted by law. These funds are spoken for, and they are pursuant to the Help America Vote Act. And if there was, if it seemed vague, you could certainly add pursuant to the Help America Vote Act implementation requirements. If it wasn't clear, although I think it is clear that it's pursuant to the Help America Vote Act.
Madam Chair, I'd make that motion to just delete that if I hadn't.
Okay. Madam Chair. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, it is a confusing statement because even if the ballot question passes, this says as enacted by law, no law would be passed until after the legislature comes back, and fiscal 13 begins this
another
next
biennium.
July, isn't it? Oh. Is it July of 2012 or 2013? 2012.
12, yeah.
So there won't be a law until almost the end of that fiscal year. So if there's other things that are consistent with that, I don't know, maybe you don't, whether is the 1.2 million, which is almost your total budget, I think you said. Maybe that's where you amend it down to save some, if in the event that you need some more of that going into the next fiscal year for implementation if, in fact, it happens. But I don't think this language, I think, is restrictive and may mean that you couldn't spend most of it on anything anyway, if that was what it was, because it won't be enacted into law.
Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
Is there a motion on the floor?
Senator Stumpf has a motion on line 1.14 that would remove the language after act, so it would pursuant to the Help America Act, period, which would give that $1.2 million to the Secretary of State's office with no purpose.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could address that, I would be more in favor. The intent of this is to set aside money in the event the amendment should pass. So if that would be the case, what I would do is, as the author, I would author an amendment to the amendment, if I could, and I would amend it to read to delete everything from line 1.12 through 1.14. What that would then do is leave $1.2 million in that account until the next legislature should convene in next year. And then if, in fact, the amendment should pass, they would have funds set aside so as not to strain the budget that we will be looking at next year as well. And this would just be a jump start for that. So that would be my amendment to the amendment that we delete from 1.12 through 1.14.
Senator Perry, I think we'd have to act on Senator Stumpf's motion first, because otherwise it eliminates the whole section.
Madam Chair?
Senator Stumpf?
Your earlier statement that leaves the $1.2 million for the Secretary of State without purpose, but according to all the rationale on how that money would be spent, was she just mentioned it, that it has to be consistent with the Help America Vote Act.
Correct, so, Senator Stumpf. It would have to be used for general purposes in the Secretary of State's office, some of which others could argue have already been funded through their regular general fund appropriation. This is an enhancement for that. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, since this isn't the budget year, last year was any of the Help America Vote Act money appropriated for the purposes that for which it's intended, so that this is actually a supplement to that? So that, in other words, you're not left without being able to carry out the things relative to voter registration system, because that was budgeted for in the budget year.
Well,
now I don't know if were you allocated some Help America Vote Act money last year in addition to general fund money for the Secretary of State's office?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, the office has consistently spent about $1.2 million each fiscal year. And last, in the budget discussions, the Senate appropriated the full amount of Help America Vote Act funds, but the House did not. And in the final negotiations, we were only appropriated $1.2 million. So we were basically given 1 year's worth of the Help America Vote Act funds that we needed for this election cycle. So we were appropriated some funds. It was basically 1 year's worth, and so we're back asking for the second year of the funds.
It's my understanding, Senator Perry, that we could act on your motion first, although if it does prevail, it changes Senator Stumpf's motion.
Madam Chair, if I could just add that it is my belief and some of others that the Secretary of State has adequate funds at this point to carry out what is needed to be carried out. And that was why we were intent on making sure that there were available dollars if, in fact, this amendment passes. It's going to help relieve, we believe, the budget next year for the Secretary of State, and we believe that that is the important part of this particular bill.
So if your amendment passes, it will leave $1.6 million, isn't that correct, in the fund?
That's correct.
For whatever purpose next year's legislature would decide?
Absolutely. And again, Madam Chair, I say if in fact this passes, they will have this money that they can delegate however they want, because we've been hearing how much the Secretary of State is saying it's going to cost if this amendment passes. Even Ms. Frazier here today said tens of millions. Well, we believe that there's enough money that has been appropriated to the Secretary of State to handle their duties, and the next legislature will have this to deal with at that point in time. And they'll have new knowledge of whether or not this amendment passes, and then can allocate that money back to the Secretary of State. But I guess my feeling would be is it would be nice to have that amount of money to kickstart something that could happen.
Senator Stone?
I'm confused. Ms. Frazier, if the amendment passed, can you still, or could you at that point use the Help America Vote Act dollars for the preparation for the voter ID processing of the amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, I guess a lawyer would need to say whether changing the Constitution is as enacted by law, or whether it only an act of the legislature and an administrative rule is a law. if amending the Constitution is considered as enacted by law, then I guess we could use some of these funds to begin preparations, but it would be hard to do very much without clarification from the legislature as to exactly how some of the procedures would should be implemented. The House has taken a slightly different approach to this bill and has reduced the total appropriation to $750,000 to our office, which would leave just over $1 million in the account. And I don't know if that's something the committee would want to consider instead of reducing it to $220,000.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonna.
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, I'm a little bit concerned because we are in a presidential year. And so if the Secretary of State's office is saying that they generally use that 1.2 in costs associated with elections and we're in a presidential cycle, to just delete that Section B, because, in fact, it did seem as though it wasn't appropriate to put the 1.2 towards implementing requirements as enacted by law. That didn't seem to fit, given where we are legislatively, and so that did seem funny. But yet, on the other hand, I suspect that if we had passed it the way it was written, the Secretary of State might have had some flexibility within their office to utilize those dollars, and they probably would have. You know, I don't know the way that the statute would have managed the use of that money, and I guess Ms. Frazier could tell us, but it seems to me that if we had passed this, some of those ongoing things would have been used with this 1.2, even though the language said for implementing voter photo identification requirements. So I am concerned that we'd be leaving a pretty significant hole in their working budget to meet the requirements of the HAVA Act in an election year.
We should probably, I think we understand what we have here, so we should vote on Senator Perry's motion to delete Section B, and if that doesn't pass, we'll vote.
But, Madam Chair, I guess I can't vote because without hearing the answer to that question about whether or not, you know, we're able to if Ms. Frazier thinks we're able to accomplish our duties to fulfill an election year HAVA requirement set. I don't know how to vote.
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I don't believe that if this language were to pass, I don't believe that our office would be able to spend any of the $1.2 million until and if the constitutional amendment were to pass.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, what do you have in your budget that was passed this last year that is a biennial budget, combination of HAVA as well as your regular budget? Will it carry through the election year? I think that's the issue as to whether whether there's something that needs to be done that isn't covered, that absolutely has to be, either, if not all, what portion of the HAVA Act monies would be essential for carrying out the responsibilities for this upcoming election.
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the general fund appropriation and HAVA appropriation for fiscal 12 and 13 was a total of just over $12 million. The appropriation general fund and HAVA for 10 and 11 was 14.9, for 8 and 9 was 14.4, for 6 and 7 was 14.2, for 4 and 5 was 17.6, for 2 and 3 was 15.8. So this is significantly less than has been appropriated to us as a combination of Help America Vote Act funds and general funds going back to 2002. And we do not believe that we currently have the resources needed to fully support the local election officials in the administration of the presidential election.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Perry,
we would contend, this is where we differ a little bit. We would contend that they do, and that we're being responsible here, looking to the future. I mean, the dollars will be there, and if we're not going to set it aside specifically for something, something that potentially could move forward, then it would still be our intent to make sure that those dollars are available, and the next legislature would then have the opportunity to work with the Secretary of State to appropriate those dollars effectively and efficiently. It would be like developing the savings account in the event of, and we believe that that's the proper way to move forward.
Senator Perry, as I look at this, you had $1.2 million for the implementation of the Help America Vote Act if it passes. But we still had some money on the bottom line. Could we not give them an additional $200,000 in addition to the three items already listed here, which would give them $420,000 right now? Some of it specified funding and some of it not. And then we could still save, it would still be saving $1 million too. We'd still have that much sitting there. I'm just thinking that we should probably loosen up a little of this for this year's election.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
I was thinking along the same lines of why not change the up on line 1.10. You have $120,000 for support of local and elected officials. Why not make that, just add another zero on the end of that, so that there would be $1.2 million.
Senator Stump, I don't know if the support for local elections needs that much money. If it said local and state elections officials, you could do it.
Maybe we should.
Madam Chair, let's do this. I can tell that you have a thought process going, and you're deep within, and I've admired all session or since I've been with you on how you've taken a look at the finances and stuff. With that in mind at this point, then I don't know, Mr. Bodern, how we would do that, but I would be agreeable with the chair's suggestion of rather than deleting 1.12 through 1.14, I think we could insert in line 1.12, delete 1.2 million, and insert 250,000.
So on, we're looking at 1.12, it would be $250,000.
Correct.
Is appropriated, and then also implement Senator Stump's amendment, so we would take out the language that it would be used for implementing voter ID.
Correct.
Which would leave money on the bottom line for correct. That purpose if indeed the constitutional question passes.
I would be agreeable if Senator Stump is.
Madam Chair, I was when Senator Perry was talking about he thought the Secretary of State had enough money for the upcoming elections. I was trying to come up with an amendment only if the Republican Party does not have any
recounts.
Yeah.
That's up to the voters too, Senator Stump.
If they
give us such close votes that we have to end up with a recount again, we just can't guarantee that issue. And now we'll have a few constitutional questions on the ballot too that could require recounts besides all the offices that will be on the ballot this year. So,
Madam Chair, we do have a bill to reduce the threshold at which a recount would kick in. So that's one option. But constitutional amendments actually are not eligible for a recount.
They aren't?
They are not.
Wow.
So
whatever comes out after the results are counted the first time is pretty much it.
Madam Chair, I believe that there can be a contest of the results, but not a recount.
Madam Chair,
Senator Stump?
It would be nice to have a little bit more than, what did you say, 450,000?
250,000. I think we probably should go with that. That may be the best you're going to do right now, Senator Stump.
Okay. All right.
So, Madam Chair, would it be, as I understand it, it would be 250,000 is appropriated in fiscal year 2013 to the Secretary of State from the account established in Minnesota Statute Section 530 pursuant to the Help America Vote Act, period, and the rest of the line would be gone. Is that how I understand that?
So, Madam Chair?
Senator, we have two motions. Would you want to withdraw your original?
I'll withdraw my original.
Your original motion to delete all of Section B.
I'll withdraw.
Senator Stump could incorporate that into his motion.
Or we could vote on his, and then he could change the number as a separate amendment.
We could, but we could save a step if he wants to incorporate it right now.
Yeah, I know the hour is getting late here.
Yes.
I'd incorporate it.
Senator Stump incorporates that. So we're giving $250,000 to the Secretary of State's office under the HAVA rules and plus the other provisions in the bill. So all in favor of Senator Stump's motion signify by saying aye.
Madam Chair.
Aye.
Wait. But this does eliminate that last line?
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. It does.
It's not dedicating any money right now to the voter ID.
I know it bothered me that it says as enacted by law. If we kept it, it should be if elected by law, and I don't think it should be there at all, so I support the amendment.
Okay. So, again, all in favor of Senator Stump's motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Is there any other discussion on Senate File 1832 as amended? If not, all in favor of Senator Perry's motion to adopt Senate File 1832 as amended and place it on general order, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator Perry, and thank you, Senator Gazelka, for waiting so patiently. That was going to be quick, but appreciate your patience.
Madam Chair, I'm good. Maybe we're in the last week. Madam Chair, I believe that we are taking up House File 2458, and I'm not sure the procedure to take the House language, so I'm not sure if that's already happening, but that's what I want to do.
That's an automatic, Senator Gazelka.
Well, Madam Chair, with that, I guess I can explain the bill if you'd like, and then there will be a couple of little amendments that I'm hoping others will offer that some of the departments would like. But the allows for advisory inspections. So upon the voluntary request of a person to a state agency for an advisory inspection for the purpose of complying with state law, agencies must move forward with that request. There are certain stipulations about when and how and why. But if an advisory inspection results in findings that potentially could make a person subject to a fine, there is a process in place where that individual would be given a 60-day notice of what to correct. And if they corrected it, there would not be a fine. So the whole concept behind it is changing the role a little bit and asking government to work with the business or work with the farmer when they want to do things right. They're afraid of getting a fine. They can bring that, whether it's ag or health department or commerce, to take a look at something and correct it. The fee would have been charged to the agencies. This new language basically, if somebody requests a advisory inspection, they have to pay for it. And so there may not even be a fiscal note anymore. I think that's the case. The House made some reductions. There might be something there. But that's the bill in its general form. And again, there's a couple of brief amendments. I think I'd prefer Commerce Department and the Health Department to make their comments and then offer the amendment that they want to do so everybody can see what they're trying to do.
Thank you, Senator Gazelka. Just to clarify that there is a fiscal cost, but the fee will offset that cost, and so in the end it doesn't cost the general fund any money.
Thank you.
So, Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, I just envision the departments just getting, you know, lots of phone calls. I want an inspection here. I want an inspection here. Is that really going to work?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonner, that was the first draft of the bill and where the problem of what you just said would likely have been the case. And so that's when Commerce and Health Department and others got engaged to make it, I think, better.
So we have some people to testify on the bill. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, Peter Brickwoody from the Department of Commerce. I'll speak. I'll let my colleague, Matt McCauley, from the Health Department speak more generally for other agencies, and I'll restrict my testimony to the impact on the Department of Commerce, which is fairly unique compared to the other agencies. I believe you have the fiscal note for the House file as it moved through the House side for you members, and you'll notice that the Department of Commerce makes up over half of the cost, both in terms of dollars and FTEs, for the consolidated note. That is because the size of the pool of eligible applicants for the Department of Commerce is on the order of 348,000 entities that would be eligible to request an advisory inspection under this language. That's nine times larger than the next largest state agency's pool. With that said, that's the explanation for why our portion of the fiscal note is so large. And Madam Chair, as you pointed out, with the House language, that is offset through a fee-for-service model, and that is reflected. Senator Gazelka has worked with the department, for which we are very appreciative of, to address our primary concerns, which relate to our financial institutions divisions and financial institution and insurance divisions. The entities that are regulated by those two divisions already have a regular examination schedule with the entities that they regulate and have this type of relationship that Senator Gazelka was describing already in place. Additionally, in both areas, but particularly in financial institutions, we have agreements with federal counterpart agencies such as the FDIC and the Federal Reserve to alternate examinations of state financial institutions. What that means is there's a reduction in workload both for the state and also a reduction in the regulatory burden for those entities. They have a regulatory agency in their offices far less frequently if they are healthy. Our concern would be that if the bill were to pass as it is currently drafted, that we would have those agreements canceled, and there would be an additional workload to the state and an additional regulatory burden for those entities. Representative Torkelson, who's the House author, and I would be remiss to not take the opportunity here to thank him, as we didn't get an opportunity to state that on the record in a committee in the other chamber, worked with us, and we helped take a partial step that way. Senator Gazelka has been gracious enough to complete that process, and the amendment will be to fully exempt the Financial Institutions Division and the Insurance Division of the Department of Commerce, which would ameliorate those concerns.
Madam Chair, that's the A1 amendment that I would need somebody to offer, and I would consider a friendly amendment.
Senator Olson offers the A1 amendment. So this is actually removing the financial institutions from the provision. Anything else?
Madam Chair, it is the entities that are regulated by financial institutions and insurance divisions at the Department of Commerce. That includes state-chartered banks and federally chartered banks, credit unions, industrial loans and thrifts, mortgage loan originators, and those types of financial institutions, as well as insurance companies.
Senator Hamm?
Madam Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment, but I would like to ask a question.
I've already done it.
You already did it.
Okay. Senator,
I'm sorry. And I don't move it. I just accept that. But just a question. By doing this, what does the fiscal note, for example, in the original fiscal note, there are 51 FTEs in Commerce. What does this amendment do to that number?
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, it will reduce the fiscal note by, I think, 11 FTE and somewhere on the order of $1 million. I don't have the math right in my head, Senator, but I can do that for you quickly offline here. The reason why the fiscal note remains large is because the total of that 348,000 and change number of eligible entities, the bulk of that is in areas of the department that is not financial institutions and insurance. We have 200 and what's the current number of state chartered banks? Currently 293 total state chartered banks. For example, this would also apply to our securities division, of which there are currently 120,000 individuals registered to sell securities in the state of Minnesota. So, Senator, that's why I think we would reduce the total number of entities that are eligible from 348 to approximately 342,000. So that's why the fiscal note still would remain large. But as Senator Roebling pointed out, there is a fee-for-service model, so any of those eligible entities that requested an advisory inspection would be assuming the costs of paying for that work.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What was the driving factor for this legislation?
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It came from Representative Torkelson. He approached me about carrying this on this side. I read the bill. I like the fact that we are giving people an opportunity that are not bent on criminal activity to come in and ask the government to take a look at something more as a way of correcting a problem in case there was a problem without having to pay a penalty. There is language in here that says if there was the very last section, I believe it is, if there was a likely event that could lead to criminal penalties, those are, you know, they may call them in, but they still have the right to stop the advisory inspection and proceed in a different direction.
So there really wasn't, Madam Chair, there really wasn't a drive to reduce inspections or simplify them or anything like that. It's just purely to the advisory inspections. It doesn't eliminate the random inspections the departments do, or you know, what
Mr. Brickwedding?
Just a layer on top of everything that was existed?
Yeah, actually, Madam Chair, if I can answer that question. Senator Stump, my name is Matthew Colley. I'm with the Department of Health, acting on behalf of a lot of the different agencies affected by this. And you're exactly right. The regular inspection process that all of the departments go through would continue unchanged with this legislation were to pass.
Okay. If since we don't know how many people will take advantage of this, what will be the process that the agencies go through perhaps to add additional staff? Will they wait to see if revenues come in before employees or inspectors are hired? What would be the process?
Madam Chair, I would refer you to the fiscal notes. Each agency has made a variety of assumptions based on their unique situations in regards to inspections. I know in the case of Commerce, their assumption was that 1% of their regulated entities would end up requesting an inspection. The Department of Health's was a little bit higher than that. I believe the number was about 10% because of the nature of our inspections versus Commerce's inspections. So we've made assumptions on how many people we think are going to request, and then once those requests start coming in, we would then have the funds to hire staff and end up going out and doing those inspections.
Thank you. Senator Hand?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sort of to Senator Stump's point, is there in the fiscal note assumptions that suggest that if these advisory inspections occur, that some of the penalties that would be assessed or the fines that would be assessed would be diminished? Is there some reflection of that in the fiscal note?
Mr. Colley?
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, I would say that when that would be appropriate, that would be within the assumptions based on the individual agencies. I think, if I remember correctly, and from health's perspective, we don't anticipate there would be a large reduction in that sort of activity. So in our case, it would be relatively negligible, but I think that would differ based on the agencies and their inspection process.
I would think that as they got pre-inspected, so to speak, you'd find a lot less problems later on and might be able to spend less time at any site after that. The inspection period might be much quicker.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Brickwedding.
Senator Stump, you've highlighted one of the reasons why the Department of Commerce was concerned about financial institutions and insurance companies, because we have a regular examination schedule that's set and accepted and is part of a body of work that's done by regulatory agencies at states all around the country. To the extent, though, that the bill applies to other entities that are regulated by the or granted permission to do business by the Department of Commerce, for example, insurance agents. The Department of Commerce does not currently have an inspection program with them, and so this would represent a new body of work for the department. So I can't speak to the other agencies, but at least in those areas surrounding licensing from the Department of Commerce, we don't have an inspection period. To the extent that the department were to undertake an enforcement action based on an investigation, that would be something that would be initiated via a complaint to the department by a party. The department would investigate that complaint and take action accordingly if it were warranted.
Madam Senator Chair, Stump? Just in response to that, it just seems that, you know, and I realize that there's probably areas or businesses or some aspect of commerce that isn't, you know, kind of living up to what they're supposed to. But it just seems like things are functioning now with the way things are, and it seems like this seems to be a whole new layer of processes that's being put in place, and I'm not sure the justification for it is there.
Senator Bono?
Madam Chair, Senator Gazalka, I know, you know, when you get to this point in the process, and you've obviously worked very long and hard with the various departments, and your House author has done the same, and so, you know, you never want to hear negative things about your bill in finance.
But I would have to echo Senator Stump's concerns. I'm concerned on a myriad of levels. I'm concerned that we're adding staff, even though we're paying for that staff that we're adding. I think, you know, we've been hearing this mantra of we want to right-size government. We want to really examine what functions government should be doing and what functions should be done and could be done in the marketplace. And so I think having a pre-inspection done for on a fee-for-service model by our state agencies is an expansion of their functions at a time when, you know, there are limited dollars available. And so I don't like this expansion of staff, whether it's paid for with fees or not. I can understand that in the background you're trying to be citizen-centric and responsive to the consumers, and I think that's a laudable goal, and I agree with you. But I don't think we have to create a whole framework in law for every agency, with exception, to do pre-inspections for a fee. I think with the exception, anybody who calls and says, I have a question and I need some help, I know when constituents have called me and I've called the agency, they go out and do that. They actually do. I have not heard any complaints since I've been here that our agencies, whether it was under Governor Pawlenty or Governor Dayton, that our agencies are not responsive to a citizen wanting some advice in this area. I have heard complaints about our inspections, no offense to our agencies, but I have heard those complaints. And so if there is a need to do some kind of pre-work prior to an inspection, just like one might approach going to their accountant prior to an audit and asking for some help preparing for the audit by a professional prior to the audit taking place, I could see there might be a need to start that up in the marketplace to help our, you know, if there is a concern around overcharging of fees during inspections, maybe there's a way to ratchet that down. I don't think the structure of this bill making this a bureaucratic expansion is the way to go.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Senator Gazelka.
Senator Bonoff, I first of all, it's voluntary. Secondly, it's they're not going to hire people unless the requests start coming in. So we're not going to be adding people in that case. And I think the 10% number is probably an overestimate when you figure that the person is going to have to pay for it. You know, so I don't know that it's going to be huge that way. And I guess what I don't know, and maybe these guys can help, but, you know, if somebody calls and asks for advice like you're saying, is there the potential for a fine now? You know, and maybe they can address that, but because I haven't asked that question, but I wonder if they found something, you know, if they would have the 60 days now, or the way this is listed, you would have a definite period of time to not get a fine.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonoff, I'd say that at least from the Department of Health's perspective in terms of people calling in and asking questions, if someone just has a general question about how to comply with something, our programs have been very responsive in giving them advice. In those particular instances, we don't normally go out. The actual inspections would be on a regular process, but people can call in and either be directed to the appropriate documentation that might help them, or our staff would answer questions to them currently.
To that point, Mr. Chair, have you had very many citizens or companies or organizations that have said, would you come out and do a pre-inspection?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I can't answer that question because I don't know. What I've been told by staff is they regularly receive questions about things and answer those questions in the normal course of customer service.
And Mr. Chair, yeah. Senator Bonoff, with specific regard to both our financial institution examinations and insurance examinations, we have a dialogue-based process with those entities. Oftentimes, they will close with a private letter that's non-public to both the senior staff and boards of a bank or a state chartered credit union or other financial institution, indicating we've seen some things that we would like to see looked at over the course of the period of time before we come back for another inspection, or excuse me, examination. And those issues are addressed in the next regularly scheduled examination. Additionally, there are circumstances that warrant our examination staff needing to come into an institution more frequently. For example, if a bank starts to encounter trouble, which we've seen in the last several years, regulators come in frequently, both from state and federal organizations. So specific regard to those two divisions, which the A1 amendment would exempt, we do have that process in place.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as long as we're kind of having a more free-ranging discussion about this whole process, which I think is good and useful, do the departments periodically review their inspection regimen to determine how productive it is? In other words, if you're doing 1,000 inspections of a certain kind of thing every year and you find two problems, is there any thought to say, well, maybe we don't need to do so many inspections, or maybe we need to, you know, change the periodicity of doing that, or is it just a schedule and you do them regardless of what the result is? Or what kind of analysis exists of the whole inspection regimen? I know there's a lot of complaints about too much and so forth, but if it's productive, I guess we should continue. But if it isn't productive, then I would think there should be some concerted effort to try to find a structure that is better. And I just, any work done in the departments on that?
Who would like to answer that question?
Senator Han, with specific regard to the Department of Commerce, financial institutions and insurance companies are on a statutorily set schedule for examinations. And so that is done by law, both at the state and federal levels. With regard to the other entities that we have a regulatory relationship with across the rest of the department, we do not currently have an inspection process in place with those entities.
And, Senator Mr. Chair, to the point about statutory schedule, I appreciate that, but that's part of my question. Is that statutory schedule productive, or is it just arbitrary, and we just say we want people to be inspected every year or twice a year, whatever it is, and people do it without a thought of what happens? If you're doing inspections and you're not finding anything, at some point, I would assume you'd come back and say maybe I'd change that schedule.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Han, I do have our acting deputy commissioner from financial institutions and one of our assistant commissioners from our insurance division to, if you'd like, we can provide a little bit more history about that because they're more versed in how that canon of law was built up over time. I would add that there are minimum standards of practice in place across the nation through accrediting organizations, and to the extent that a state were to become an outlier with regard to other states' practices and minimum requirements set out by the federal government for the examination of financial institutions and insurance companies, that could potentially jeopardize the state's accreditation and our ability to conduct joint examinations with other states. understand your point, Senator. I think that accreditation and that process that we have in place now actually also helps relieve regulatory burden on the companies that are domiciled here in the state. For example, if we were to lose if our agreements with federal counterpart agencies such as the FDIC and Federal Reserve were to be canceled, a well-run community bank, a community bank in good standing, could expect to have a regulator either from the state or from the federal government in their offices every 6 months. If you are a bank that's in trouble, you would expect to have a regulator in your office every 90 days. And the process takes some amount of time. So you could basically set up an office for those regulators and have them in your bank year-round. And so that, by having these agreements in place, we are able to not only deploy the state's resources more efficiently, but also relieve some of that regulatory burden for our companies that are doing business in Minnesota.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think some of the things you're talking about now are ones that would be removed from with this amendment.
Yes, Senator.
So we're not talking about those kinds of inspections, but I'm trying to understand or figure out why anybody would want to do this. If I presume, and maybe that's an unsafe assumption, that you provide information on what the expectations for any of these functions that would ultimately have an inspection, that they know the rules, they know what's required, they know the consequences. I mean, is that information readily available to these organizations or individuals, if they're a self-employed type of individual that would be in it? And if that's available, and I don't know if it's whether it's website or a contact line or through their legislator to try to get some information if they get stuck with listening to recordings all the time, it would seem to me that most entities, the big ones obviously have their whole internal audit procedures, but that those are the kinds of things that you would want to examine, do self-examination to determine whether you're meeting those requirements or not. And I'm having a hard time understanding why one would actually want to go through an advisory inspection versus just seeking information to become conversant in having some confidence that if inspected, that they would be meeting the provisions of the law.
Mr. Senator Chair, Senator Olson, to that point, you're right. The bigger companies have their own internal inspections. I work for a major corporation. They internally inspect us like what would happen if we had an inspection. But if you're a small mom-and-pa restaurant or a small business or potentially a farm or whatever, you don't have those kind of resources to do that, and you may decide that you want a voluntary inspection to make sure that you're doing everything you're supposed to be doing right without the fear that you're going to get fined for doing that. And so, that's where I see the potential for this. When they have to pay for it, that'll lower that, and that's okay. But as a small business, you don't have those resources. And yet you may want to make sure you're doing things right.
So,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, you don't feel that the small business has enough information to know what they should be doing and be able to self-examine their practices or work with their staff as to what those expectations are in their own modus operandi, that you'd want to risk calling in a government agency?
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I mean, that's a fair question, but the first that's part, right. No, they don't have the resources. In my own insurance agency, I get all kinds of data coming in from the company I work for. Watch out for this. This is an area that people have had problems, et cetera, where I get that because I have a larger company that's looking out for me to make sure I'm doing things right. But a small mom-and-pop individual business owner, they're not going to have that kind of stuff. And I don't know whether they're going to take advantages. I get the fear factor. But there are so many government regulations over so many things that you can't keep up with it all. And so I think that's the genesis of this. But, this is good dialogue to see if we're heading in the right direction.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, so that means that our entities, our agencies, aren't communicating, or that information is not available to people in a user-friendly way so that they, in fact, know what's expended? Is it coming to the, I get from some of these larger entities, you get these thick brochures of fine print that you have to have magnifying glasses to read. And I'm not sure if anybody ever reads those. I certainly don't have enough hours in the day to find out what in the world is going on as a customer of what the expectation or what the promises are. Is that what our small businesses are getting confronted with, whether it's related to health kinds of things or whatever they might be inspected about? Because that, to me, is... would be a normal course of an expectation of business that has some oversight, that you have good communication so that they know what that expectation is, And you would think that most of them would have the capability. I mean, I don't know what resources other than just being somewhat knowledgeable and knowing how they train their own people that they hire, if they do hire outside other than doing everything themselves, and be at a restaurant or whatever, they'd want to be able to feel confident that they're doing things right without having to call in the, excuse me, enemy, trust themselves to it, that the outcome would be, because I, you know, we hear tales. We get the worst of it when somebody, they feel like they've been trapped and there seems to be no recourse.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I mean, I think that's a fair description that a lot of small business owners may have of the government. You know, they're the enemy. And this is an attempt to try to change that, you know, so that we don't have such an adversarial relationship. And it is about too much bureaucracy and trying to keep track of everything. You're a small business owner, you've got to be an accountant. If you're in the restaurant business, you have to know about food and, you know, if it rots and how long you can keep it. I mean, depending on what your business is, there's many things you'd have to know and do, quarterlies and unemployment and all the other different responsibilities that you have that you may not be an expert in, and it's hard to keep track of it all. But, and it is because we have too much bureaucracy, I think. This voluntary idea of inviting them in to avoid penalties and make sure you're doing right, doing it the way it's supposed to be done, I think is a possible tool for them, not required.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, and on the same subject, you happen to have Senator Hance, Senator Olson, myself representing the same city, the city of Minnetonka, and the only problem they've had with inspections is that they have wanted to be able to do a shared service arrangement with a neighboring city to do their inspections. And in fact, our Department of Health, I think in this case, or Department of Ag, perhaps Department of Ag, I think, has not let that occur. And we've had, you know, year after year, we've had this complaint. And so I'm sort of here on the side of the folks who I interface with think of us as the problem, not the solution. Yeah. And so I hear that you're putting forward something in an attempt to become the solution. I don't think that helps. I think that it has the potential to create even more layers with regard to the whole inspection and the relationship between government and the business community. If there is a problem, I suspect the marketplace will create a solution for that problem and figure out how to work with each other to make sure that they're reducing the amount of fees. Because no business can survive if they're over getting chastised for this problem or that infraction. So I just, again, am wary about increasing a potential bureaucratic solution when I don't think that's the direction we ought to be going.
Any other discussion, members? I do believe we still have the A1 before us. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The list of exemptions is, and I think it actually, on the amendment, you can see it on the bottom of page 2, and then the list goes on page 3. There are a significant number of exemptions, like the one that probably should not be exempted if this is going to be a, you know, business, kind of a business helper, the Department of Revenue is. At least it's my understanding. Is that how you see it? This section does not apply to criminal penalties. Am I working off the right document?
It's so confusing.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's right and what's wrong here.
It's the A1. That's not in.
delete everything?
So the amendment now is this little short one.
Yeah, but what is it? What is it amending? Which of the three documents, the Senate file, the House file, or the delete all amendments?
We have the House file. My understanding is we have the House file before us, 2458. We have an A1 amendment drafted to House file 2458.
And what's the delete all amendment?
That, I believe, was drafted to the Senate file, but we have the House file in front of us.
Okay.
Is everybody clear on that?
So Mr. Chair, 3.25 is the Department of Revenue. You're saying that you'd rather have them in.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and it seems like the list is still in there. This section does not apply, and then if you go through that list, there's a fair amount of the things that government is involved in is actually exempted out.
So what's left?
Well, it seems like human services. If you look at the 3.32, state inspections or surveys of hospitals, nursing homes, outpatient surgical centers, supervised living facilities, board and lodging with services, special services, home care, housing with services, assisted living settings, hospice, and supplemental nursing services. So that's a good.
Mr. Culley.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, that list is for the Department of Health, so I know of that one in particular. But more generally, the list of exemptions on here, the first part of them is mostly for areas in which we're taking out why you wouldn't want to do an advisory inspection of. So if there is something that's constituting fraud, that shouldn't be an advisory inspection. That should fall under the regular inspection process.
Sure.
And then when we get down to the exemptions that pertain to individual departments, and I'll use number 13, the MDH exemptions as an example. They apply to the unique situations in which those inspections occur. So in the case of things like hospitals, nursing homes, et cetera, what we're really talking about here is going in and inspecting things that affect people's quality of life. The idea behind the advisory inspection process is that someone is able to find out relatively minor things that they can are given a grace period to correct. Well, in these particular areas, we're dealing with people with quite often with unique special needs and things where the corrections really need to happen immediately, and our regular inspection process is already built into allowing that with minimal impact in terms of fines or penalties if the infractions aren't severe.
Any other questions, members?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I guess now I have a question of what's left is eligible for the advisory inspection. The list is so long of those that are exempt. We were talking about these little restaurants in Minnetonka. They're already out, the dairy and food inspection of the Department of Ag. If they provide free inspections.
Who has the answer to that question? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I can just step in on the restaurant one, and then my colleague can step in on other areas. The Department of Health actually inspects food, beverage, and lodging areas. So that includes restaurants. And the Department of Health, before any exemptions were put in here, had 38,000 entities that are regulated by the department. The exemptions you see in here for the Department of Health under number 13 accounts for only about 2,000 of those, with the vast bulk of the remaining 36,000 being restaurants. So when we were looking as individual agencies at what we were wanting to exempt from the advisory inspection process, we really tried to narrow it down to only those unique inspections that don't really fit this model, while leaving as much of our inspection process as we possibly could to fall under the purview of this legislation were it to pass.
And before we get to the second part of that answer, Senator Han.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow along that, so you've got 38,000 entities, and this would exempt a couple thousand of them. So the rest of those, and again, going back to the question I was asking previously, what is the cost benefit to do those 36,000 entities inspections every year or with whatever cycle they're done. Is there any way that you can say, well, here's what it costs the state to do all this, and here's the benefit. Here's what's happened. We've uncovered whatever the problems might be, and those are serious, or I don't know. I mean, that's part of the question I have, and it may or may not pertain exactly to the intent of this bill, but if we have an inspection regime that we're just doing because we do it, but there's not any sense of what the gain is from doing that, I think that, to me, is something that ought to be evaluated. And I don't know if that's done. Can you tell us?
Mr. Gawley?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, I don't know if I could point, pull out a document from my file to say, here is the breakdown of what that is, but I know we routinely evaluate how our process works to make sure that we are doing it in the most efficient manner possible, and that we are trying to bring into compliance those entities that we regulate. I know at the Department of Health, we think our ultimate goal is to have people actually following the laws and regulations that are within statute. We don't like giving out fines if we don't have to. We'd much rather have people just preparing food in the appropriate way and caring for individuals in healthcare settings to benefit those individuals. And our inspection processes go out and try to bring about that. And we really don't like going through the process of having to fine if we don't have to.
And now to the second half of the answer to Senator Olson's question.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, to answer your question more specifically, the list, and this is also to Senator Stump's point, I suppose, as well, the list of exemptions that you see in the A1 amendment, which would add a sentence to it for the Department of Commerce, represents a combination of items that were originally in the bill as it were was introduced, and then some work, which we are very appreciative of, between the agencies and both Senator Gazelka and Representative Torkelson, to identify specific areas in which either, A, we have this type of process in place already, so the bill would be duplicative, or B, to address situations that warrant immediate attention, such as health and safety issues, or issues like in the case of the Department of Commerce, where there would be some unintended consequences that would actually result in significantly more cost to the state and more regulatory burden to our businesses here in Minnesota. So I think that, again, for the Department of Commerce, currently as the bill is drafted, would apply to over 348,000 entities would be eligible to request an advisory inspection, with the exemptions listed in the A1 amendment, that number would be reduced to 342,000 approximately. So there we'd be removing approximately 6,000 entities from their eligibility for such a process because they have that type of relationship in place now. But the vast majority of the entities with which the Commerce Department has a regulatory relationship would remain eligible. And Senator Hand, to the question that you were asking, I certainly can check with our staff to see. I think that it's somewhat difficult to the reason why we have an examination process for financial institutions and insurance companies in the state is to ensure the safety and soundness and the solvency of those entities, because not only are they major employers in the state of Minnesota, they do business here. Minnesota consumers do business with them, and to the extent that those entities are financially impaired in any form or fashion, that poses a significant risk to Minnesota business and consumers. And so I think it's somewhat difficult to say what is the effect of those examinations, because I think that sort of presupposes that you think about what the environment would be like if we didn't have those examinations at all. And so you would sort of imagine scenarios and of things that could occur, but they may also not occur. And I think as the market changes, our examinations are also able to take into account those types of effects with the financial concerns that we've had over the last several years. Our examinations have helped identify banks that have or financial institutions that have been having troubles and help them work through that to an extent. And in the event that there have been financial institutions that that have had significant difficulties. We're there to help unwind those problems in an orderly fashion.
Madam Chair and
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. And Senator Hand, I do have a question that I will get an answer back for you from the Health Department. How many yearly inspections and how many yearly fines? We have some perspective on that. We do have three amendments, this one and two other short ones. I would at least like to see if we can move those forward.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I would renew my amendment, but I do have another kind of question, and maybe I'll just lay it out there, but I think we should vote on this one and get on with it. But I'm sitting here thinking, if you were to make a list of those for whom this provision is intended, would the list be longer or shorter than the list of exemptions?
Senator Gazelka.
Hence the problem.
Right, you can wait for that if you want to go ahead and vote on an amendment and go on with it. It may be partly rhetorical, but if there is an answer, it would be interesting to hear. But
all right, unless there's further discussion, we have, again, the House file before us and the A1 amendment, which is drafted to House File 2458. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The amendment is adopted. Is there another amendment we need to offer?
Mr. President, on line 4.4 through 4.6, I believe there's some concern. Forget that. Just testing you guys. Sorry about that. On line 3.1 through 3.7, I need the Matthew to testify on that.
Mr. Colley?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is a series of concerns that sort of are more broad-reaching, sort of affect all the different departments. And after talking with MMB about these particular lines, as the administration, we have some concerns about the requirements that it's placing on our hiring abilities after being provided what we need to be doing and the funds to do so. So from a budgetary perspective, we would prefer that the allocations that in this bill be made to perform work outlined and required by law because we support the fee-for-service model and that we have some concerns about legislative restrictions on the executive branch employment practices and staffing levels. So if the lines that Senator Gazelka brought up were removed from the bill, our concerns in those areas would no longer be present.
So, Senator Gazelka, are you suggesting that someone move to strike the language starting on line 3.1 after the period all the way through the period on line 3.7? Is that?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's correct.
Okay. Well, I will let Senator Olson make that motion.
Well, I'm not sure I want to. You better.
Well, let's have some more discussion.
Explore this.
Before we entertain a motion, do you want to speak to that anymore, or is that an adequate description?
I would hope that was adequate. If there are any clarifications needed, I'd be happy to take questions.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Roebling.
Well, then I am concerned about, I mean, you would be committing to not adding staff unless you know there's a need for it, which I think is what this kind of guarantees us. We don't want a lot of FTEs in place, and then nobody pays the fee and asks for the advisory inspection. Then we've got people sitting there doing nothing. Mm-hmm. So, this gives me comfort that they won't be sitting there doing nothing unless the money's coming in.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the lines actually, there are two parts to it. The first part is. The first line, an agency may not add additional staff until a certain date. And then the second sets the requirements for when new staff can be added. In both of these instances, it boils down to a separation of powers issue in that as a state, we don't practice complement control through the executive branch nor through the legislative process. The legislature passes things that tells us what to do and how much money we get to spend it, and then it's under the executive branch's authority to make sure that is implemented in the most efficient and appropriate way possible. to write this out in this way is, in some respects, redundant, and in other respects, a imposition upon the executive branch authority to carry out what is required by law for us to carry out.
Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, having been through a gazillion, seems like, budget cycles, we do put in complements. I mean, that's the basis for budget and funding it. This law would have to be signed by the governor, too. We don't, nobody's doing anything independently. We pass laws, and I think there's an expectation or the communication there, and if it's agreed to, the governor would sign it. If it isn't, then he won't. But I don't see how that is a usurping, usurping the executive authority. That's a line for some reason, it's the first time in all the years I've been here that I've heard it so many times from so many different agencies that somehow there is the legislature doesn't have any role in this, in managing. Essentially trying to have in place policies or restrictions or whatever that would seem to get a handle on whether it's the growth of government, whether it's, to see that trying to get efficiencies worked on from within. So I do have a bit of difficulty with that response that somehow this is just automatically usurping executive authority, because I don't think that's the intent, because this has to be signed by the governor. He would have to agree to it.
And Mr. Chair, I'll just say that this is their perspective. I will respect the wishes of this committee.
Any other discussion on the bill, members? Well, we have Senate or House File 2458 in front of us. I don't know that anyone has moved that bill. So we have it in front of us, but I don't know that we have a question before us.
Mr. Chair, did
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, did Senator Gazelka say you had another amendment too?
I do not. I thought I did, but I do not. Okay. Mr. Chair, I love those smiles. Well, Mr. Chair, if there's no one to move that, that is the bill as presented and amended. I'm looking for somebody to move the bill as amended.
Come back next year.
Okay. Well, Senator Robley.
I think that there's still some questions about it, and maybe we should lay the bill on the table. Yeah. So I would make that motion.
Okay. We have a motion that House File 2458 be laid on the table. Is there discussion on that motion? Senator Gazelka, any comment?
I respect the wishes of the committee.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. The motion does prevail. The bill is laid on the table.
Okay.
We've got a hearing tonight. We can take it back up.
Members, thank you, yes. I think we are going to adjourn, and I will give you a heads up, though, that after there's a committee report that we may receive from the floor on the stadium bill. And I can't say for sure, because they're acting on it